My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences. Whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Welcome to Mentor, I'm Mark Boris. Tim Duggan, welcome to Mentor, mate.
Thank you very much.
Did you have far to come?
No, I've been staying in the city.
You live in Sydney?
No, I live in Mallorca.
Ah, Mallorca.
Yes.
Cool. And now we're telling Mallorca, like Spain?
Like Spain, yeah.
Like, so, is that like an island or a coastal area?
It's an island in the Mediterranean,
yeah.
Part of Spain. It's next to Ibiza and part of the Balearic Islands.
Wow.
Yeah, so my husband and I moved there.
That's mental.
About a year ago. And
you live in an island in the Mediterranean in Spain. I guess that came off the back of selling your business.
Yeah, and experimenting with how I work and how I live. So I fly back to Australia about 3 or 4 times a year and spend the rest of the time over there.
Okay,
working for Australian companies.
Okay, that's cool. Like, we'll come back to Junkie Media, which you're the founder of. But and you and your husband live there. Obviously, did you meet him there?
Or no. We met in Australia 10 years ago.
Yeah,
he's Scottish.
A Scottish guy.
Yeah, and so he'd been living in Australia for 10 years.
But of course, they're used to traveling everywhere through Europe, especially Spain and Portugal. So
yeah, and I had been married to my business.
I wasn't
able to really leave the country.
So you didn't know much of what's going on over there?
No. You visit there. You go for a holiday for 2 weeks at a time. But we wanted to move to be closer to his Scottish family for a couple of years, but didn't want to move to Scotland. Too cold.
Understandable.
Yeah, beautiful place, but not to live.
Not to live, no. Especially when you come from Australia. But you're Sydney.
Yeah, Sydney based. Yep. So grew up in Sydney.
Grew up in Sydney.
Yeah.
If you don't mind, can we just explore living in Mallorca for a second? Post selling a business or post unloading what was a lifetime of building, generally speaking, it involves giving away everything and sacrificing everything. But then all of a sudden you've got this sort of freedom to experience other things.
Yeah.
What's it like to – why did you pick Spain and why did you pick Mallorca?
Yeah, and it's really interesting because there's obviously good parts of selling a business, and my co-founders and I sold Junkie Media in 2016 and I hung around till 2020, and there's the freedom that comes with that. There's also the loss of identity.
Because that's a problem because you identified yourself as Junkie Media.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I joke that my surname was From Junkie because I introduced myself. This is Tim From Junkie. So that loss of identity was something that was also interesting. And this happened in 2020, and I'd been working towards this for 10 years. So figuring out, let's sell the business. I had an earn out for 3 years. I hung around for an extra year. And then we were going to go and do the big let's live overseas thing that I'd wanted to do my whole life, but I'd been married to my business.
You had actually had a longing to do this.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
To live overseas or just visit overseas?
Just to live overseas. Yeah. I'd lived in Sydney my entire life until I was 40. And
oh my God, you look like you're about 30 something now.
Cheers.
Something's going on in Spain.
Yeah, the beautiful Spanish sun. And so we tried to move overseas in 2020. We couldn't because of COVID. So instead, when we sold the business and left it after 15 years, I jumped in a camper van with my husband, and we traveled around Australia.
In Australia, yeah.
Yeah, for 6 months. Then eventually we put together a spreadsheet of all the things that we wanted to live. And it was things like access to beach, because I'm Australian.
Yeah.
Good airports with great access. Wanted to learn Spanish so I could have a skill when I came back. Sort of,
that's a big call.
Yeah, and that limited it then to Spanish-speaking countries, of which there's quite a lot.
Yeah, it's true. You could have gone to South America.
Yes.
Mexico.
Yeah, yeah. That was on the list.
Oh, really?
But access was important for Ben's family coming from the UK. It's easier to get them to come to Mallorca than it is to get them to come to Mexico.
Yeah. So you sort of triangulated the place based on all the demands.
Yeah, we had this list of things.
Yeah.
And then the more we looked into Mallorca, it has the fourth busiest airport in Europe during summer.
So during summer.
During summer, but for 3 or 4 months a year.
Yeah. Which is the time they're going to travel to.
Yeah.
The family.
Yeah, yeah, totally. They want the good weather.
Yeah, yeah.
They're coming there for the sun.
So what about weather when you sort of triangulated all this? I mean, what is the weather like in Mallorca all year I'm talking about?
It's sunny for 300 plus days a year.
Oh, wow.
So it's really sunny. It's almost... so it's in the Mediterranean and you've got Algeria next to you. So you sometimes get like the desert kind of dust and things like that on this island. Winter is about a Sydney to Melbourne winter, maybe for like, 1 month or 2 months.
Yeah.
And then the rest of the time it's just beautiful.
And what's the people, is it mostly non-Spanish people there?
A lot of Spanish people, and we try and associate with as many because we want to try and learn Spanish, but a huge expat community. So there's about 1 million people live in Mallorca, and we live in Palma, which has about 500,000 people. So big enough to feel like it's a big, small city.
It's a decent size.
Yeah.
Not overwhelmingly big like Sydney can get.
Yes.
And how long have you been living there now?
So 1 year. So we are officially digital nomads because Spain introduced a thing called a digital nomad visa.
What's that?
Which means that if you get your income from outside of Spain, you can go and get a Spanish residency for 3 years because you don't take a job of a Spaniard and you pay taxes and you contribute to the economy without taking anything out.
So and what's the tax rate like? Is it an expensive place to live?
Yeah, it's about the same as Australia.
Right.
We have a double tax treaty, which is good. So
you don't have to pay twice.
They do have a wealth tax.
But that are based on what you accumulate, I guess.
Based on everything that you own.
No, Joe.
Yeah.
Like around the world.
Everything around the world.
What the fuck? Like, you mean if you own something in Australia, like it's something in, Oxford Street and it's gone up, five times what Paddington's done, that they're going to tax you on that annually or when you die?
Annually.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. So it's a price of living there. And that's okay. I don't mind paying high tax at places because generally places with high tax have good welfare and good services, and there's a reason why they have that because lots of people want to live there.
And is it party town?
It is if you want it. I'm past those days, Mark.
Yeah. Because, you mentioned Ibiza. I mean, I've never been to Ibiza, but I've been to Spain quite a few times, but I've never been to Mallorca. But I think of Mallorca and Ibiza as the same, and I think of Ibiza as mad fucking mental parties are going all night and everyone's on the gear and there's got foam machines and spraying each other foam machines.
Is part of that. And so Mallorca has that as well. Mallorca is huge, particular for UK tourists and German tourists.
Right.
And there's entire towns that are German enclaves.
Wow.
You go there and all the signs, street signs are in German.
No.
And there's German doctors and German medical centres and all the foods are German. There's beer halls. Then you go to the next town and it's all English breakfasts. And, louts.
Is it an Australian town?
In the street. Not really. No, it's just the Brits and the Germans.
Right. So I
avoid most of those towns just because that's not what I'm there for. I'm not in Mallorca to go to a German beer hall. I'm there for the beautiful beaches and I adore hiking. It's one of my favorite things to do. And there's this beautiful mountain range in Mallorca that you can hike and kind of get away from it all.
So a lot of people talk to me about their journey that they want to go into a business. They want to leave working on a salary and they have ambitions of building their business up outside of what their passion is. I'm not talking about the passion for the business. I'm talking about just as a lifestyle exit process. And they sort of look forward to the day where you are now. But if you then go right back to the very beginning, what they forget about is in order to get to where you got to today, you have to have a successful exit and you have to have money to do what you've done. You have to have made a lot of dough.
You also have to know what you want. And that's the part that I've interrogated deeply for me.
In terms of
what fulfills me, what is success to me?
Yeah.
Is it a big house?
What is it?
Bought cars, freedom, and the ability to do what I really love doing. And so the sale of the business bought me freedom.
But did you know that when you kicked your business off?
No. I co-founded original website, a gay and lesbian website called Same Same, with three of my friends who'd started a website called In The Mix. This was in the mid-2000s. I was 24, 25 years old. I'm not thinking about what I wanted to do or that this was a business that was going to grow into something or...
Well, why did you do that? Why did you set up Same Same? Like, what was the thing?
Yeah, I became really interested in communities. And so I started putting on events. I came out as gay and I felt there wasn't any events for me. And so I started putting these fun events on at the time. And then it was around the time when the internet was rising and communities were starting to migrate towards the internet. So Same Same to me was a place to have a place for people to go and meet each other and talk and read the news. This is when the internet was slightly a happier place than is today.
It's not as hectic.
It was pre-Facebook.
It's fully hectic now. Like
the internet is a very different place now. But this is when it was, you know, not to view it all through rose-tinted glasses, but it was a better place to be.
More community-based.
Yeah, more community-based. Yeah. So I wanted to just take that community of people that came to my events and bring them somewhere online. And so that is where Same Same, which is the first website, started in 2006. So,
but was Tim Duggan, was he a journalist at that time?
Yeah, I was always interested. I came straight out of school into ad agencies because I was interested in marketing. So I started in the mailroom of an ad agency. I don't even know. I doubt they exist these days, mail rooms.
No one gets mail anymore.
Yeah. And so delivering mail. And then about halfway through, a couple of years into that, I realized that I really loved writing. I watched Almost Famous, the movie, about that young kid who starts working for Rolling Stone. And being young and naive, I said, I want to do that.
You want to work for Rolling Stone?
Yeah.
The magazine.
Yeah, the magazine. And this is without any formal writing experience or really without much writing experience myself.
Did you work for Rolling
Stone? Yeah. I emailed and called up the editor of Rolling Stone and didn't tell her how old I was. I was about 19 or 20 and didn't tell her I'd never written before. And just what I did was I saw Rolling Stone was particularly focused on rock music. So it was like really guitar heavy in Australia. And I was really into electronic music. So it was like Chemical Brothers and Orbital and all these like really amazing bands. And I saw that there was a gap that no one was covering it in Rolling Stone. So I said to the editor, you need to be covering this sort of music over here. There's a gap. And she ignored me for a few emails. And then finally she said, here's a CD. She put a CD in the mail. And she said, can you write a 50-word review for me? I wrote about 10,000 words. Like just trying to like write and like I didn't know what I was doing, just writing. Eventually edited it, simplified it down, and then sent it off to her.
Who was on the CD? Do you remember?
I ended up doing so many reviews at the time. I can't remember who it
was. It was a compilation of people.
It was an artist.
And one
artist. It was one artist. Yeah. It was reviewing their CD for Rolling Stone. Because in the back of the magazine, they say, here's an esteemed reviewer, and this is what they think about this CD.
Particular.
And that was 19-year-old me who had never written before. And I remember sending it off to her. And as soon as I pressed send, I was just like, she's going to find out I'm a fraud. I can't write. Who do I think I am? What an idiot you are. Just all those self-doubts that come in. And then to my surprise, a week or two later, she wrote back and she went, yeah, that's pretty good. Here's another one. Can you do 100 words on this? And that just grew and grew. And so then I was writing all these feature stories on electronic artists in Rolling Stone.
Is this outside the advertising agency?
Yeah, it was around the same time. I did advertising and then did uni part-time for a couple of years just to kind of figure out if I liked it. And then around that time I left advertising and started into kind of journalism. And that's what led me to then also launching Same Same. It didn't just come out of nowhere.
So Same Same came after the Rolling Stone stuff.
Yes. Yeah, Rolling Stone and then a bunch of other I kind of did writing for Sunday Telegraph and lots of other kind of places, like every magazine that I wanted to. I had that, you know, the energy and naivety of youth, which is I saw somewhere I wanted to write for.
And the front.
Yeah, and the confidence.
You got to have front.
Yeah.
If you don't have front, it's not going to work.
Yeah.
You got to sort of back yourself. Well, and a lot of times it's about naivety, though. It's about I mean, a lot of people say to me, oh, where do you get your confidence from? Like, not so much now, but when I was younger. But, and it was usually front, like, to be honest, you're not thinking about it too much.
Yeah.
Just say, oh, okay, whatever. I'll do that.
Yeah.
I'll have a crack.
That's
it's as silly as it sounds.
That's how same started. It was, sure. Like, there was no big grand plan around let's do something. It was like, let's have a crack. I can do this.
So if we could talk about that for a second, because I think it's really important. And you've probably experienced this with other people too, but some people, my experience, they're over analytical and they think not so much what could go wrong, but what could happen. And they have this ability to, a great ability compared to me, to analyze all the outcomes, possible outcomes, and all the possible problems. Because the moment you start looking at it, you start to find problems. And then you're hypothesizing into the future, none of which can be solved.
Yeah.
Because they're not actually problems. They're a hypothesis. And there's about a million assumptions around each one. And as a result of that, they shit themselves and they didn't do anything. I was not that person because I didn't possess that capacity or that ability.
Yeah.
It's an ability I didn't have, which resulted in me doing things which they probably wouldn't do. Is that something – would you agree with that?
Yeah, 100%. I think I can basically trace back my career and sitting here today back to a couple of things, decisions that I made without even thinking about it, just things like I sent an email – I started my events company by sending an email out to a bunch of friends saying who's interested in this, and within a week 1,000 people had signed up to it. That mailing list grew and grew, and that became same. So when I launched the first community website, then same grew and grew. And then in 2013, we launched Junkie, which is a pop culture title for millennials. That grew and grew. And then we sold it. And then most amazingly, I rediscovered my love for writing and my passion for writing, which I had not done in 15 years because I'd spent the time building a business. And I can trace all of that back to just being, you know, having not really thinking too much and just starting something.
I've never really thought it through. Therefore, I'm sort of struggling with the words, to be honest. And I'm actually looking to you for a bit of help here because you're a writer and you're probably much better with words than I am. You're the wordsmith. But it's sort of like naivety, but it's sort of equally, sometimes I think about this about myself as I just didn't care.
Yeah.
I didn't give a shit.
Yeah.
I didn't think about it because I didn't give a shit. I didn't care less.
Yeah.
I just said, I'm going to do what's in front of me. And I often say to people, stop thinking about all this stuff. Just play what's in front of you. Like, that's all you can do. You can't, because otherwise you're sort of reaching out everywhere.
Yeah.
And you're not effective anywhere.
I also think sometimes when people hear these stories and your story and like the, you know, things that I did that were great that led to this thing, they don't hear about the 100 other things that I also did.
Errors.
Yeah, that just kind of like the fuck ups that that went to a complete dead end and I moved on from them. But by doing 100 of those things, 2 of them worked out. You know, like starting a website and writing to editor Rolling Stone. And all of that has led me to where I am today. But it's about that experimentation and it is a bit of naivety, but it's also just I don't really give a shit around what happens.
Without being careless. You're not careless.
Not careless. It's more your ego. Yeah. I don't kind of give as much a shit because every time you launch a business or business idea or even to send an email to someone, you're putting your ego on the line. And every time I email the editor of Rolling Stone or an editor of Vogue or GQ or someone I wanted to write for, there's a part of me that I'd press send and that part of me would the imposter syndrome element would come in and be like, oh, is that right? But the more I did it, the quieter that got.
Yeah, so it's very interesting. You sort of quieten down and eventually you smother this thing, this imposter syndrome.
Yeah.
This thing that sort of makes you challenge yourself as to your credibility and or your right to be this person.
Yeah, but I view it as a positive thing now.
No, totally.
I've written 3 books now and I still, when I send a draft off to my publisher, hit send and there is now it's like, you know, 10% of me is just like, oh, is that any good? Before it used to be 90% and over the years that's gone down and I hope that never gets to 0%. I hope that I never send something off to somebody and think, that's fucking amazing. That I've written just the biggest opus in the world. That's when you have problems.
So can you just take from same to Junkie Media? So what was that transition like? So did you sell same or just close it down?
We did sell it, yeah. So that was one of the first websites we sold to a gay and lesbian print publisher. Interestingly, a few years later, they shut down. So then the whole website kind of went with it. But we sold it because it wasn't our focus. And there was three original founders that I joined. So then there was four of us. And two left the business.
This is Junkie?
Originally it was called Sound Alliance. So Sound Alliance was a kind of a company that same was part of. And then there was four founders, two left the business. And then it was my business partner, Neil, and myself. And we were primarily a music-based publisher then. So we had a bunch of music titles. And we realized that there was a bit of a ceiling on how much you could grow with just one niche part of already what was a niche, which was digital media. So we did a bunch of research on our audience to try and figure out, you know, who they were. And we kind of identified this new young person coming through. It was before they were even called millennials. They were just young people. I mean, back when, you know,
before. But now everyone's called something. So
it was millennials.
There's no need to call them something in those days. It was just
young people.
But now we have this thing we have to call everyone, categorize everyone
as
something.
Yeah, yeah. And sometimes they sweep in generalizations about, you know, the entire generations. But we felt that there was this real moment happening. And the moment was young Australians were wanting to engage with news and information, but in a smart way. They didn't really have a place to go to. And there was also the rise of Facebook. So Facebook, this was 2013, 2012. This is when Facebook used to be good as well, when had this opportunity to expand and build big audiences. So we launched Junkie then in 2013. And it was one of our suite of titles. We had about five or six titles. And within 6 months, it had just blown up. It had really found an audience of smart young Australians and ridden this wave, so much so that we then rebranded the whole company as Junkie Media a year or so later.
So, before I go to the break, I just want to clear this in my head. So, because I didn't fit into that cohort of people, so I wasn't following it. But especially in terms
you're excused,
of age,
it's okay.
But Junkie Media was a news outlet.
It was.
But how did you choose the news, and what and was there something different about the style of? Because we see things like the Daily Oz, for example, at the moment, who's a news outlet for younger people, but it's done through bite-sized Instagram pages. Mm-hmm. What was your thesis back then?
Yeah, so our thesis was. Junkie originally stood for pop culture junkie. Mm-hmm. So the idea that someone's really into pop culture. Mm-hmm. And we started off posting content around news and movies and TV shows and music and things like that.
Media news or news general?
No, news generally.
Right.
So it was like Taylor Swift has a new album out and here's what's happened. It was, new movies coming out here, kind of stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah. Entertainment news.
Entertainment news was how we originally started. But then within a few months, at the time Tony Abbott got elected Prime Minister, this was kind of back then in 2013, and a lot of young people felt that decided to get pretty politically engaged at that moment because they kind of felt their Prime Minister didn't really reflect who they were. And we harnessed that political engagement to write fun, funny, interesting, opinionated news. Which was quite unusual because for young people, I think they were used to kind of pretty much straight down the line, whereas we took a side and we had added humour into it. It was funny, smart, ballsy and interesting. That was the content that we're trying to write for people.
And Tony, who I know actually, he's not a bad dude, but like Tony being an easy mark.
He was an easy mark.
Because he's just so easy to get.
He ate that onion. Remember when he ate an onion? Just and
also run around his sluggos, you know, like just everything. Like
he was easy. He was an easy mark.
Yeah, for someone like you guys to take the piss.
Yeah.
Sort of.
Yeah.
But at the same time giving news.
And then we became equal opportunity piss takers. So we then could do it kind of around everyone. So it was that. And then news and opinion and analysis kind of grew. But it was interesting when we first launched, it was meant to be just pop culture.
Yeah.
And we really had to listen to the audience to kind of change that content.
It's quite an interesting story in terms of how it would have evolved too. I mean, you didn't sort of sit down and write this all out and say, well, this is what we're going to do. We're going to go after, because he was not the Prime Minister at the time. But when he became the Prime Minister, you're listening to your marketplace.
Yeah, we reacted and responding. To it. Yeah, and we used, the way that we thought about it is we published to social media. And we published about 500 pieces of content a month. And we viewed each of those as an experiment. So I would sit there. There was programs, one called Chartbeat, which was like live and real-time analytics. And every time we published a piece of content, we would analyze it, and we would have, you know, weekly and monthly meetings on what was performing, what wasn't performing, what was bringing to the people to the site. And that is how we informed our content strategy.
Yeah.
It was really, it was kind of the art and the science. Yeah. That's how we viewed it.
Well, especially going back then though, like I can understand people doing that sort of analytics now, but if going back then, there was not a lot of analytics
and
stuff.
It was just new. It was relatively new.
It was a sort of hit miss type thing back then. You would just say, oh, that worked. That didn't work.
Yeah. It was, I think Facebook. So we did rise on the back of Facebook and a bunch of publishers worldwide. So BuzzFeed, Vox Media in the US, Pedestrian in Australia, Junkie in Australia, Vice, we all had this huge rise, which was around the period when Facebook was giving access to all of Australia to brands that could figure out how to kind of hack the algorithm, how to create content that people wanted to click on.
Yeah.
And so we just like rode this algorithm wave up to really big audiences.
Okay, I'm going to go to the break. I'm going to come straight back. I want to sort of dig in a little bit into Junkie. And I also like to know how you sort of worked out it was time to exit. Let's go to the break. Come straight back.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Back from the break, I'm here with Tim Duggan. Tim was, I mean, he doesn't own anymore, but he was one of the founders of Junkie Media, which started off as a sort of a pop culture news media organisation, but then obviously responded to his audience over time and started to become something more than that. I don't really know how to describe in particular what you became, but it was a news outlet.
It was a digital publisher for millennials.
Yep,
how we viewed it, and we published news. It was video. I would say within the 15 years of kind of running the whole business, there was many different revenue streams and different ways of, so I'm not surprised if you are kind of trying to find the words of how to describe it, because we had to morph along with the market.
Well, it's interesting about that though, when you just made your description, you made your description about your audience, not about your content. So, you know, it was a news media organization for millennials, whereas most media organizations are about their content.
Yeah.
I'm a news organization which delivers current affair, or I'm a news organization which, you know, delivers stories around rugby league or, you know, tennis or sport, et cetera, or health. Yours is about your audience.
Yeah. And that's intentional.
Yeah.
As in, we've really put the audience at the center, and we made it our job to know more about millennials than anyone else in the country.
And you applied in those days particularly a lot more analytical tools.
A lot of analytical tools, a lot of research. Yeah. We worked every year, we commissioned independent research to help us understand what titles should we launch, what content should we do. It was a real amazing example of the opposite of set and forget. It was just, this is our audience, and we were constantly looking at them to tell us what to do.
Is that because your audience, once you identify the cohort of people you're talking to, and I guess we're talking to people from 16 to 28, or I don't know.
At the time, it was roughly 18 to 29, then it became 18 to 30, and then it became 18 to 40, because I consider myself the world's oldest living millennial, and I'm kind of right at the top of that group, and it just kept on growing and growing and growing. Millennials now are, you know, 25 to 45.
So that's why you have to keep evolving, though, because the next group of 18 to 28, given that you're now 18 to 40, or currently 18, would be 18 to 40, then you have to cover a much broader audience.
Oh, yeah. We're just constantly looking at what is coming through. And so we launched a sister title to Junkie called Punky, P-U-N-K-A-A, where we focused on Gen Z. and that was less politically engaged. It was more.
Is that right? They're less politically engaged, are they?
Yeah, there's. It depends. I mean, it's hard to.
They're less interested in the current politicians.
Less interested in current politicians, and we focus that intentionally. The way that we then split the two was Junkie was kind of like the things that matter, and Punky was the things that don't. So it was a way of us kind of like splitting some of the audience, but that wasn't a reflection just of Gen Z, because Gen Z are still politically engaged.
Yeah, but they're not so much interested in who the politicians are. They're more interested in the in what the political content is. So like, you know, it's unfair that I have to pay too much rent. It's unfair that I can't get a place to live in. Why don't you have policies that allow me to get places to live in? They're not actually looking at, you know, Anthony Albanese or whatever. They're not. That's my understanding.
Yeah, interesting.
Whereas the millennials, your generation,
yeah,
you're quite interested in the individual, and you'll target the individual. Say, you know, this is something you need to do.
Yeah, I mean that's probably a good broad summary of the difference between how they view it at the time. And so we launched Punky 5 or 6 years ago, and it was a way for us of just differentiating between the two brands. So just so we could kind of talk about harder things on Junkie and lighter things on Punky.
So so Punky, or that generation, the Gen Z, are you saying they're less intense?
No, it was around the rise of TikTok was coming through. So talking about things like TikTok personalities that no one else was talking about. I mean, there's a lot of differences in generations. I think one of the most interesting differences is how Gen Z approach work in particular.
Yeah, tell me about that.
Yeah, so... in fact, I've just written my third book called Work Backwards, which is all about
this book right here.
All about the future of work and how to rethink it. And one of those things is I did a heap of research around what's going wrong with the way that we're working. And I spent 2 or 3 years going into it, and I was quite dismayed.
The way we're working now, or
currently working. And so looking at things like burnout increasing, and looking at overwork and apprehension and disengagement. All these indicators are kind of going in the wrong direction. And that to me says that the way that we are currently working is broken. And Gen Z in particular are looking at their parents and their older brothers and sisters and seeing all these problems, burnout increasing and all these things going in the wrong direction. So Gen Z have a slightly different relationship to work, where for them it's not the most important thing. Hustle culture and girl bossing and things like that are not seen as a positive thing. For this is, of course, a generalization. It's not every Gen Z. But generally, Gen Z, so younger than 23 down, have a very different view of work and what it takes to succeed and what success is.
Let's just quickly talk about the book, because that's it's about a cohort of people, an audience, and you're talking about their attitude towards work.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
So in terms of when you say they don't approach work with the same ethic, perhaps, and I don't mean principles, I'm just talking about like a approach,
yeah,
to the way we work, as say your generation
and above,
and my generation, yeah. My God, like, you know, you left school, you went to university, you went to work, and you saved up and you got a mortgage, and then you had kids, and that was like, That's your life, and then you work to the day you turn 65 and you retire, because you can't wait to turn 65. Which, like, who's in a hurry to turn 65? For God's sake, nobody. Right. Should
you
be.
You are like literally describing what work backwards means in this book, which is the way that we've traditionally thought about it: is work first, that gives you money, and then you build a life off the back of that.
Yeah,
and that becomes kind of a cycle that happens. And the whole book is about actually reversing that, thinking life first. Who am I? What's success for me? How much money do I need to live that life? And then what work should I do, or what tools can I use in order to make my life fit in with the life that I want?
And is it possible to do it, though?
It is.
It is. So, I mean, having lived in or living in Mallorca like you do, has that sort of changed your – did that help form these views?
Yeah, a bunch of things helped form them. One, leaving Junkie after 15 years. That for me was who am I, what's my identity, what do I want to do?
Talk about that, please. Yeah. I mean, because just talk about that straight away. Let's not move away from that, because we all fall in love with our business. You said earlier you were married to your business.
Yeah.
Let's call it fall in love with our business. And what so much so that we convince ourselves that our surname is the surname of the business, yeah. or the name of the business. So we no longer Mark Boris, we're Mark Yellowbrick Road.
Yeah.
And in your case, you know, Tim
from,
Junkie.
From Junkie, yeah, totally.
Tim from Junkie.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Tim from Junkie. And by the way, you probably went to conferences and events and shit like that where you introduced yourself that way.
100%.
I'm not Tim Doug, I'm Tim from Junkie.
Not something that doesn't happen without our own, you know, impetus.
We started.
Yeah.
And we then keep affirming it. In our brain, we keep building this story about ourselves.
Yeah.
That we are the dude and that we are Tim from Junkie. When you go to sell that business, all of a sudden someone takes away a massive part of your life. Well, you think so anyway.
Yeah.
And at the time.
And in that case also, I chose, you know, that was something that we chose to sell and then I chose to leave. For many people don't have a choice in that. So if you're made redundant and work as part of your identity, disaster for you. If you retire – and that is part of, you know, who you are as a person.
Which is the thing that worries me, Tim, like, because I see people, I know, you know, I'm in that category. I've got mates who have worked in the same job for 30, 40 years. They've turned 65. They retire and then they fucking die.
Mm-hmm.
Because they've got nothing to do.
Yeah.
They're not, I don't mean in a physical sense, they do not have anything to identify with.
Yeah.
They get depressed. There's a downhill thing.
That's exactly what the book is about. So not just retirement, but at any stage. And this my simple way of dealing with that is if you're going to change direction and live life in a different direction, you need to have a map. And a map stands for you need to know what meaning you get from work and what meaning you get outside work, what your anchors are, so your core values, and what your priorities are. And if you know what meaning you get from work, but also outside it, that helps you when you retire or if you have redundancy, your meaning's not completely intertwined with everything that you do just between 9 to 5.
So are you saying then day one, if you work backwards, then day one when you kick off, you've got to try and make sure you sort of detach yourself. And we hear this in the Buddhism all the time about this not attaching yourself to things, whether it's material things or conceptual things as well. So you've got to sort of basically detach yourself from the business you're working in.
Yeah, and you do that by grounding yourself in who you are without that business.
So your own values.
Your own values, what you're kind of – and I think that we spend so much time thinking about business values. We, you know, you write it up on the wall and we have workshops talking about what the values of your business are. Very few of us think about what values I am as a person, and that is way more important than a business value.
Give me an example of some of the values. So we're talking about like in terms of – usual virtues like I'm respectful, I'm generous, I'm blah, blah, blah.
Yes, yeah, there's a bunch of them. And in the book I got the top 50 most common ones.
Right.
So for me, my values, optimism is a huge value of mine, fairness and equality and community.
Right.
They're kind of like my values. And so they're not unique to me, but how I order them and how they kind of come to life. And you get most of these values from parents or from mentors or from people that you admire.
Yeah. So, but if let's say someone just kicking off, I mean, where does that, how does a young person or a person for that matter, evaluate of, let's say, the 50 virtues that or values or things we stand for, life stands for? How does someone choose? Because you can't do all 50, it's too hard. That sounds like a lot. I mean, how would you say to someone go about choosing these things?
There's a really simple exercise, which would be think of someone that you really admire. So someone you look up to. Could be someone you know, or it could be someone in the media, or it could be someone, a celebrity. And then start listing out what are the qualities in them that you admire. Like, what do you admire in them?
Outside of materiality.
Outside materiality, yeah. But it could be-
outside of being famous.
Yeah, like you're looking for the values that make them them. Yeah. So, you know, like...
What's admirable about them?
Yeah, you want to kind of get to the core. This is not about like surface level of they have a nice car.
This
is more about they're really freaking honest.
Or they've got... it's outside of they've got a hot Instagram page.
today. Yeah, it's outside of that. We're trying to get to the core. So I call them anchors because I want to differentiate them a little bit from work values. So an anchor suggests it's something that's at the core of somebody. And that is ideally it's someone you know because you can, you know, it could be your parent or it could be an uncle or it could be your boss or something like that. And start listing out what are the values that you admire in them. And then you then start looking at the top 50 most important anchors. And sometimes things jump out at you. And that's when it happens. And then you need to test this out with your partner or a best friend because you can sometimes say, oh, I really value being trustworthy. and someone says, you're a bloody liar. that's not one of your values. So it's really important to test it out with someone.
Yeah, yeah, that's pretty cool. So, and so working backwards is sort of a process of, instead of all of a sudden finding yourself, you're 65 and you think, what the fuck have I been doing all my life, is giving yourself a fighting chance to not be in that position when you turn 65. In other words, yeah, recognizing day one at least, and hopefully every day of your life, what I'm actually working towards.
Yeah.
What am I doing here?
Yeah. Just all I want with this book is for people to think.
Perspective then.
Yeah, yeah. Just get a bit of thought. Because sometimes I think, I call it the default mode, is where you just get on this treadmill and it pushes you off at 65 and you get there and you realize I'm too old to do those things I've been dreaming of doing since I was 20. And
or I didn't save enough money.
Didn't look after my health.
Yeah, especially that one.
Didn't look after relationships.
Yep.
I've got there now and I need to try and repair my relationship with my kids, whatever it is. All of that happens by default without thinking. You just get on this treadmill and you get off. And so that to me is like, you're just doing and not thinking. So all I want is for people to just like have a moment to just reassess and look. And for me, that moment was, I said, I left my job after 15 years, COVID happened, which was a huge, you know, global experiment. And my dad passed away in 2022. And that to me was a hugely important moment. He was my hero. Well, a lot of the qualities that I have now, I inherited from him. And that made me reconsider just, am I happy? What are my values? What's important to me? Am I living the life I want to live? And those three things happened. That's where the germ of this book came from.
We close because it's running out of time. But like your exit from Junkie Media, which was 2016.
Okay. Yeah.
So what was it that prompted that?
Yeah, it was a couple of things. One, it was timing. So we could see that there was going to be a peak of a market.
So it was time.
Yes.
Potentially.
Yeah, yeah. It was time. That was important. Two was, myself and my business partner had worked for ourselves the whole time, and I felt like we got to the limit of what we could teach ourselves, and we wanted to learn and be part of a bigger company and just get those extra business skills that you get. So we decided to take it to market. So we got an advisor on board. We took it to market, and the process is you start off with this list and there was like 30 companies and it's all amazing, and slowly the list whittles down. And whittles down.
Down about two.
Yeah, down to about two. And then we got to two and they both put in lowball offers or kind of weren't that interested. And we were like, okay, it's not the right time. So we took it off the market. Then about 12, 18 months later, within the space of a week, both of those two and then another one all came back to us independently and said, are you still interested?
Because the market wasn't right at the time.
Because the market.
They can be the right buyers. You can be the right asset, but the market's got to be right.
Yeah. Yeah. The three things. The company needs to be aligned. The acquirer's company and board needs to be aligned, and the market.
Yeah.
And we had two of those, but not that third one.
So that's interesting because you can't force a sale.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter how good you are. The marketplace determines when people want to buy.
Yeah. Not yeah. And it was the most fascinating lesson when we got a call up from the advisor saying, just had a call from company X. And then a day or two later, he's like, you would never believe this, but company Y has also called. And that to us was extraordinary. So we then reopened the process just for them. They both kind of ended up bidding against each other, and then we chose one.
Yeah, and you went through the usual due diligence period? What sort of period?
We did, yeah. And we ended up not going with the company that offered the most money.
And why is that?
Because we went with a company that was really aligned with what we wanted. There was other factors, especially for what I wanted. Staff and audience, and also development. Yeah. I had a 3-year earnout, as my business partner did.
Yeah.
And that's 3 years working for someone else.
Yeah.
So I wanted it to be someone that I wanted to work from and learn from.
Yeah, well, and most important part about that, you're right, is giving yourself the best possible chance of actually achieving the earnout. And that's got to be someone who knows what they're doing. But also, I think equally to originally, and I seem like we're aligned on this one, Tim, I like to learn. And bench strength is so important. You know, getting a really good bench, like you know, your buyer who has bench strength, they've got a lot of experience and shit. You can gain from that.
Yeah, and so an example of that is I left the business after 4 years. My business partner, who came, is still there 8 years later, in a big, huge role, really kind of enjoying and learning new things. So it was a really successful acquisition for them in terms of hires in that case.
So you sell the business, work there for a few years, get your earn out, obviously pay you some money when you're along late, you learn a lot of stuff. Then you move off. Were you married at that stage?
No. So the first thing is interesting. At the very end of the business, the three things before we sold, the three things that I was spending my time doing. So remember back, I started because I loved, you know, journalism and words and content. Cash flow, legals, HR. That's what was taking up.
That's the world.
Most of my time. So when we handed off to this company that had 800 staff, they took off all of that. So I had headspace to think about other things. So I wrote my first book called Cult Status, which is all about building a really strong community around a business. And that helped me reconnect with writing and journalism. Then got married, started being in a camper van, wrote a second book on creativity in the workplace. And then this is my third book now in 6 years.
So when was this book first launched?
1 week ago.
Really?
It is brand new.
And where do people buy it from? Is it buying it?
You can buy it. You can buy it anywhere. Workbackwards.com is the website.
And your publisher is
Pantera.
Pantera Press.
Yeah, great Australian publisher.
But you can buy it online.
You can buy it online anywhere. Amazon, Booktopia. The audiobook on Audible.
And how's it going so far?
Really well. Yeah, so I'm back in the country for 3 weeks doing a book tour and doing promo.
I know you obviously got a lot of money, you know, after the sale, you're doing well, you know, you're more comfortable with all that sort of stuff, but you're young. You've written your book, I get that. There must be something else coming. I got a feeling something else is on its way.
It's interesting that I have loved reconnecting with my passion of writing.
Yep.
And the reason why I love that is not about money it makes or anything like that. It's actually around impact that I can have. So what I really want to do with this book in particular is just help people rethink work, life, retirement, all those kind of big things. That's all I'm focused on.
Am I going to see Tim Dogan with a website and then being retained by, I don't know, some of the bigger companies who pay people come in to do contract work, consultancy work, as to how to talk to their staff about, alignment of values, helping them make sense of what the hell they're doing?
100%. I do some of that work already.
You do it now?
Yeah. And some of that feeds into all of the insights inside this book that I've been working on for the past couple of years.
Well, I love it. I quite like the thesis about starting from the end and then trying to engineer your way to that end from the beginning. That's probably the best way of putting it, yes. Starting at the end and engineering your way to achieve that from the beginning.
Yeah.
From day one.
That's work backwards.
Yeah, work backwards.
That's the idea.
It's clever words, work backwards, but sort of that's, because I often say to people, if you're going to set up your business, you're going to do a startup, whatever the case may be, you better know what your exit is and what you intend your exit is going to be and when your exit is going to be day one.
100%.
Build towards it.
Yeah.
Instead of just working your ass off your whole life and then going, oh, maybe it's time to sell. And then I don't really know what I'm selling. I haven't really worked to a marketplace. Because the marketplace keeps changing.
And if you don't know what it is on day one, the best day to know that is today.
Yeah.
So for me, when I started, I had no idea what I was doing. But halfway through, I was like, what am I aiming for? What is success for me? Yeah. What do I want to do? And that's when I started figuring this out. So it's not too late if someone's listening to this and they're like, shit, I started my business or I'm working and I haven't quite figured this out, because the best day to do that is today.
Well, work backwards, brilliant and life-changing, which is as a part of the review. Revolutionary method to work smarter and live better. Tim Dogan, thanks very much, mate.
Thank you, Mark.
Enjoy Mallorca, you bastard.
Cheers. Thanks, everyone.
My business used to be weighed down by the complexities of in-person payments. Then, Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe came along and changed everything. With Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe, I streamlined my payment process effortlessly. Now I can accept in-person, contactless payments right from my iPhone. No extra hardware required. What's truly remarkable is how I can cater to all of my customers' payment preferences, whether they're using cards, Apple Pay, or other digital wallets. Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe ensure a smooth checkout experience every time. And it's not just me. Stripe helps businesses of all sizes, from local markets to global retailers, scale quickly and stay agile. To learn how Tap to Pay on iPhone and Stripe can help grow your revenue and reach, visit stripe.com/tapiphone.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.